This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. We're still fresh into the new year. It's a time of year when we look for change in ourselves and maybe some extra change in your pocket. Now, how much of that kind of change you find might depend if your employer happens to be paying a living wage, or if your state is one of the 24 that will raise their state minimum wage this year. A lot of Americans, in fact, millions of us, have a hard time getting by even with full-time work. Costs go up, wages might, though not as fast, and the danger is that something's got to give. So whose responsibility is it to ensure all workers make enough to make ends meet? How much does it matter to employers, and what does receiving a living wage mean for workers? We'll answer that question for the start of our new monthly series, Priced Out. It's a collaboration between 1A and our home station, WAMU. Every first Monday of the month, we'll look at what it means to get by in America today and ask whether just getting by is enough. Today's installment, a living wage. WAMU's Sasha Ann Simons kicks us off in Washington, D.C.
In 2009, the world economy was reeling, and worker and employer anxieties were high as the job unemployment rate crept up, right along with mounting bills for cash-strapped Americans and sweeping home foreclosures. At the time of this economic upheaval, the federal minimum wage was $7.25 an hour. During the last decade, and at the beginning of this new year, the average cost of a house here in the U.S. rose $72,400. And food? It also got more expensive to buy groceries. This is all according to the most recent U.S. Census data. Throughout it all, the federal minimum wage has remained the same, $7.25 an hour. Hardly enough to stave off poverty, but whose responsibility should it be to ensure all people are paid enough to live? I spoke with Anika Hobbs, owner of the D.C.-based Nubian Human. I was curious about her thoughts on the idea of employers paying their employees a living wage.
Living wage is an interesting thing. You know, there's a base that you feel like people should have in order to live a decent life.
A decent life. That's one definition of a living wage, but how else could we define it? Ed Lazier, the executive director of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, had some thoughts, too.
The reason that we talk about living wages in the first place is the fact that we have an economy that doesn't guarantee that even if you work full time, that you actually have enough to meet your basic expenses. And that's really what the living wage concept is, right? What does it really take to have housing and transportation and food and healthcare and so on? And then what does that translate into a wage? The minimum wage is a floor. The living wage should be something that is much closer to what it really takes to live on.
Here's Anika again.
You know, I had this unique position of being like kind of on both sides of the fence. You know, you understand as an employer that you have numbers you need to make, you have cost per hour. I mean, I'm constantly counting cost per hour. You know, how much are we making this hour? How much is it worth? How much does it cost to have this person here this day? How many people do I have in store? How many people do I have outside of store? What does that look like? So that's something I'm constantly thinking about.
It's a lot for a business owner to keep track of on a constant basis. But like Anika said,
but then on the other side, it's like you understand that your team has responsibilities, right? Outside of just your business. So, you know, they're going to school, they have children, there's things that they're interested in, they have businesses of their own. And how does the money that you put in their pocket support that and allow them to allow that to flourish and grow along with them working for your business?
Though not required by law, Anika pays her employees the living wage in Washington, D.C., $14.50 an hour. And while it does cost her more financially, paying the living wage may be earning her something else.
I believe in her vision, so I'm willing to do more than just a regular job.
That's Jason Anderson. He's employed by Anika at Nubian Human.
You know, like a Kmart paying me a wage, like, when I clock out, I don't care. Like, I'm off. Like, don't ask me about no staplers. Like, I don't, you know what I'm saying? I don't know nothing about none of that. Whereas, though, so when you are invested in somebody's dream, like, you want them to succeed too.
But Anika didn't pay the living wage expecting anything in return.
I pay the living wage, and I want to pay so much more, you know?
The cost can be high for some business owners who pay a living wage to their employees.
I want to pay so much more. I want people to work for Nubian Human and say, I can't leave them. They're just so awesome, you know? But it's the cost is high.
Even with the benefit of receiving a living wage, when I asked him, Jason wasn't too optimistic about whether the idea of a living wage will extend across the country, or if change is even possible.
I'm just not quite sure how to go about it, because you're speaking of a system that's in place, how the country operates. That's just how the country operates. And to be quite honest, you can't reform systems like that, because they're in place and they work like a well-oiled machine.
Reform may be possible, though. Several states have stepped in, raising their minimum wage while the federal government doesn't. And here in the district, the D.C. City Council has taken some steps of its own.
Joining me right now in studio at our home station, WAMU, race and identity reporter Sasha Ann Simons. Sasha, great report. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
You spoke to Anika. You spoke to Jason. Talk a little bit more about the tension, if that's what you can call it, for people like Anika who believe in a living wage, want to provide a living wage. She is also a businesswoman and she cannot afford to go under. That doesn't help anybody. Talk a little bit more about her beliefs in that regard and what it takes.
Well, Anika has it lucky in the sense that she does have a great group of employees that understand her struggle. They understand that it's difficult for her to figure out how to do this all. You just kind of laid it out beautifully, where she's juggling with, how do I pay these people enough money that they can live and they can support their families and do what they need to do, and also make some money and support my bottom line, and recognizing that these people are just helping me pursue my own dream. And so how do I sort of balance that out? And so what she does is she pays this living wage, but she can't really offer much else.
It's not the rule in the District of Columbia that you have to pay a living wage, but the minimum wage is going up to right around that point that is a living wage in the district.
Yes.
Is this just a semantic difference at this point in the District of Columbia between
yes.
a living wage and a minimum?
It really is. Yeah. I mean, the minimum wage is $14. The living wage is $14.50. As of July 1st, 2020, the minimum wage here in D.C. will be $15. And so, we're really talking the difference of 50 cents here.
When did the District of Columbia start taking into consideration this idea of a living wage? I got to say, like, there's a national debate over a minimum wage all the time, the ghastly
yes.
$7.25 from Congress. But the idea of a living wage, enough to get by and get your needs met.
In D.C., it began 14 years ago. So it was called the Living Wage Act of 2006. And really, it shows that the District of Columbia is a longtime leader in progressive wage policy. But that being said, it's really important to note D.C. is one of the most expensive places to live, with some of the worst income inequality. You know, to afford an average two-bedroom in Washington, a worker would need to make $32.02 an hour, and that's more than double the D.C. living wage. So we still have a ways to go.
And in a town like Washington, D.C., that is gentrifying rapidly, that means a lot of things. It also means rents go up. And this constant race, right, between not only what you make, but what it takes. A.C. Monroe likes to tweet us all the time, and we're glad. If a business owner can't afford to pay the employees a livable wage, then they don't deserve to be in business, period. No one in any country, county in America today can afford to get by on the federal minimum wage. I don't know if people are quite that insistent in the District of Columbia, but that attitude seems to have taken root. You know, according to the most recent numbers, which are from 2 years ago, the living wage for the American family of four is $16.07 an hour. The federal minimum that we keep talking about is less of half that and hasn't budged in a decade, over a decade. We're going to add some more voices to our conversation with Sasha Ann Simons. So stay with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp, a truly affordable online counseling service. Fill out a questionnaire online and get matched with a licensed counselor best suited to your mental health needs. Whether it's depression, anxiety, or trauma, BetterHelp will help you overcome what stands in the way of your happiness. Learn more at BetterHelp.com and get 10% off your first month with promo code 1A. BetterHelp. Get help anytime, anywhere.
Wake up to a fresh take on the day's news with Up First every weekday morning, and now Saturdays at 8 a.m. Eastern, too.
10 minutes is all you'll need to start your day informed, and now you can listen 6 days a week.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro, Up First, to start your weekend from NPR News.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about a living wage in America as part of our series Priced Out with WAMU race and identity reporter Sasha Ann Simons. Let's add some more voices in this conversation. Joining Sasha and me in studio, Professor Adriana Kugler. She's professor of economics and foreign policy at Georgetown University. She's also the former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor in the Obama administration from 2011 to 2013. Professor Kugler, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Todd.
David Cooper is also here. He's senior economic analyst at the Economic Policy Institute. They're a nonpartisan think tank that researches economic policies and their impact. David, it's good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Professor Kugler, we heard a little bit in Sasha's piece from Ed Lazare about how to define a minimum or a living wage. But could you take a second and break that down for us a little bit more? How do we define a living wage in America? It's different from the minimum wage. Obviously, the minimum is the minimum. How do we put our hands around what it actually takes to get by versus what you can make at your job?
So a good way to frame this is to think about the poverty line. The poverty line is defined by the census, by the U.S. Census, and it's defined of the amount as the amount of money you need yearly to meet your needs, and that includes shelter, food, all the basic necessities, not beyond necessities, but just necessities. For a family of four today, that's about $26,000 a year. With the $7.25 federal minimum wage, even if you work full-time with no vacation whatsoever, that would get you as far as $15,000 a year. So that would put you way off basically being able to meet the basic necessities, which would be the equivalent of a living wage.
Not even close.
Yes.
Well, the federal minimum wage, we've said, is the same as it was in 1999. More than half of states here in the United States have laws now requiring employees be paid more than that federal minimum wage, but only about half. The minimum wage in Illinois has gone from $9.25 an hour to $10.25. Washington State has gone from $12 to $13.50 on the first of the month of this year. And on September 1st, Connecticut will raise its minimum wage from $11 to $12. David, what does all of this and all these numbers tell us about how Americans are getting by, more importantly, if they're getting by?
Well, I think it tells us that a lot of Americans are struggling to get by, and they're asking their representatives in government to do something about it. In the absence of federal action, we've had folks in, as you mentioned, 29 states across the country enacting laws to raise their state minimum wages. We've also had about 40 local jurisdictions raising their own local minimum wages, all trying to address this problem that you've discussed, that for folks at the bottom of the wage distribution, what they're being paid is just nowhere near what it takes for them to actually afford their basic needs.
We got this message from Lady of the Farm, who tweeted, "I appreciate the idea of a minimum wage, but I think it prevents small businesses from thriving and individuals from pursuing entrepreneurship." This is an old debate when it comes to minimum wage, finding that sweet spot between giving people enough to live in a fair wage versus the point where it starts to make it difficult for employers to expand and to hire. Professor, what do we know about that balance? And is there evidence that a minimum wage actually damages jobs?
That's a great question, Todd. One of the arguments against raising the minimum wage is that it has these unintended consequences on the people it is supposed to help, that oftentimes employers facing these higher costs will stop hiring people, that they will reduce the number of hours they offer to the workers they actually choose to keep. But in fact, very recent evidence and the evidence that we have actually accumulated over the years shows that there is very little evidence of disemployment.
David, we talk about a living wage, getting the basics, getting your needs met. What happens when it doesn't happen in terms of policy? What happens when we have millions of people who work hard but can't get their basic needs met by what they make?
Yeah. Well, a lot of those folks have to turn to public assistance programs. So they're relying on things like food stamps and housing assistance and whatever other safety net programs we make available to them to try and pay their bills at the end of the week. But the other thing that happens is that we potentially have a much weaker economy because, remember, about two-thirds of the U.S. economy is consumption. It's people going out and buying things. If you have an entire class of workers that are not getting enough money to go out and buy the things that they need, businesses aren't going to have customers coming through the door that they would have otherwise if those folks had enough income.
That's the policy. Let's bring it back to the personal, Sasha. Yeah. We talk about basic needs and getting them met. Mm-hmm. You can talk about here in the District of Columbia, if you like, it may not be that much different from places all across America. What does that mean for people who are working 8, 10, 12 hours a day and still not being able to get what they need?
Yeah, the idea here is that, you know, a working adult should be able to afford these basic things on their own, and like David said, without the need of private or public assistance. So the self-sufficiency standard accounts for six basic needs, which are housing, childcare, food, transportation, healthcare, and miscellaneous expenses. So that includes things like clothing, telephone services, cleaning products, for instance. And it calculates the cost with the assumption that all adults in a household are working full time.
David.
Yeah, I wanted to just go back and make a point on this question about the business response and what, you know, the harm that it may cause to businesses. And I think Anika's story at the top was a great example because she talked about the benefits that she receives from paying higher wages, the fact that her employees stick around, the fact that her workers work a little harder. And also, I would note that if you're raising wages through a minimum wage increase, all of Anika's competitors are going to be paying higher wages too, and all their workers are consumers, so they're potentially going to be coming through Anika's door to buy more goods and services.
Well, let's hear from a business owner himself. We have William on the line from Arkansas. William, you're listening to David say that paying a living wage can raise all boats in your community. What do you say?
I agree to some degree, but at the same time, we try and pay as much as we can to our employees. I agree with Anika. We've seen the same benefit. We really believe in taking care of our employees, and we've seen the benefit of that. But Arkansas is a very, the cost of living is very low. And so if you, across the board, raise the living wage up to a point where the cost of living is so low like it is in Arkansas, it could really, really damage all the small businesses. As a small business owner, it's a struggle. And there's a lot of the work that we do ourselves to save money already. And I'm just afraid that it's going to shut down a lot of our small businesses.
William, I want to thank you for joining us here on 1A. We appreciate your perspective as a business owner there in Arkansas. Connor owns a business in Toledo, Ohio. Connor, you're listening to this argument that a living wage helps everybody. What's your point of view?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm a huge fan of the living wage. However, owning my own business and trying to hire good blue-collar employees is a challenge. I have to stay competitive, but at the same time, I have a 40% workers' comp fee on top of my wages. So if I'm paying someone $15 an hour, they're seeing $15 an hour, but really that's like 22, you know, it's in the 20s an hour for me. It's a challenge to keep competitive prices in the marketplace, and slowly I'm seeing lower middle class and middle class customers being priced out of really essential tree work that could, trees that are dangerous that could.
So you're a tree doctor, Connor. You got guys climbing trees and roping up and cutting down branches.
Exactly.
Dangerous work.
And a lot of dangerous stuff over houses.
Yeah.
And
All right. Well, Connor, thanks for joining us and for sharing the details of your business. I appreciate it. Professor Kugler, two business owners who seem to have a theme. They believe in a living wage, but one size can't fit all. In Arkansas, the cost of living is low, so don't give me a living wage that's too high for my community. Connor says what a lot of business owners say, that the living wage, the wage doesn't tell the whole story. I got to pay 40% workman's comp because people are climbing trees to cut them down and I have to be insured.
So there are two things that I heard from them. One of them is that there is actually a benefit. And the benefit is reduced absenteeism, right? Increased effort from their workers, potentially reduced turnover down the road. If an individual business does this alone, it doesn't really bring all the benefits one would want. But that's why you need federal laws. That's why you need maybe potentially state laws also to increase beyond the federal minimum wage.
We've been hearing from many of you around the country, workers and business owners alike. Here's Elizabeth in Michigan.
The real truth is there are many places in America that are affordable, but they're not considered desirable. So for instance, I moved here in July of this past year. I bought a house for $25,000 cash. Nice little house, two bedrooms, big backyard, nice neighborhood. I moved here from the Phoenix, Arizona area where I lived for about 5 years, tried to buy a house for about 3 years. Cheapest house I could find was about $300,000, so I couldn't afford that.
David, Elizabeth says mobility, even if it happens to too many people, we call that migration, moving to places that are more affordable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think people hopefully have the means to find places that are more affordable. You know, if you're a low-income worker, you probably don't have a big budget for packing up the moving truck and traveling great distances to find a cheaper cost of living. But the truth is, even in the cheapest county in America, you cannot get by, you cannot achieve a secure but modest standard of living for less than $14 an hour. And ironically, that county is actually near Toledo, where the gentleman was just speaking. So if the truth is, you know, even though folks are maybe searching for lower costs of living, we need to be talking about minimum wages significantly higher than they are today in most of the country, if even in the lowest cost areas of the country, if folks are going to be able to achieve a secure standard of living.
Sasha, I'll take you outside of the District of Columbia. There are reports of people in Los Angeles making $50,000 a year, a great salary, living in their cars. Because they can't afford rent anywhere in LA, even on a salary that to many, many people would seem like a dream. Now, that's LA, maybe where the cost of living is especially high. It makes me wonder what you found out about how not getting what it takes affects people's lives, what they have to do to get by when they can't get what it takes.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's clear. The bottom line is DC is super expensive, as I mentioned earlier, and the living wage rate is simply too low. And so for people like Jason Anderson, who I spoke to, who works in Anika Hobbs' store, you know, the living wage for him was the difference between being able to support his two young children and not. Mind you, he works part-time at Nubian Human and has two other jobs. So he's working two other jobs plus this $14.50 an hour job. So it all has to work together in order to be able to make ends meet. And but common sense and, you know, the cost of living here in D.C. will tell us that the living wage, like I said, is unrealistically low.
We're going to take a break, getting through so many of your comments. Workers, business owners. Harry sent us this email. I don't see how a living wage is justified for a job that requires a minimum skill or education level. People should be paid according to what they bring to the job. A clerk at Target or a cashier at McDonald's does not deserve a living wage unless the job market forces higher wages in order to fill those vacancies. Deserve is kind of a loaded word, but after this break, we're going to talk about living wages in places like McDonald's and Targets and Walmarts and Amazons and what it might do to our costs. Hey, I love shopping at Amazon. I don't want my prices to go up, I'm going to be honest. So we're going to talk about effects across the economy, what it means for all of us if a living wage becomes policy. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stick with us. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Did you get a smart speaker for a gift over the holidays? Well, consider it the gift that keeps on giving, right? Because it can help you keep up with the news. Just say play NPR to hear your local NPR station and all your favorite NPR shows as well.
Welcome back to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. I read Harry's email before the break saying that workers of a limited skill level or education shouldn't necessarily be paid a living wage. A clerk at Target or somebody working on the register at McDonald's doesn't necessarily merit a living wage in the economy, and we should be careful about overinflating those wages. You wanted to respond, David Cooper.
Well, I think, you know, that may be Harry's philosophy, may be that we don't need to help those folks, that everyone's out, you know, on their own. But I think generally as a society, we have felt that folks should be able to afford their basic needs. And we have to find some way of ensuring that they do, either through labor standards requiring businesses to act in certain ways or through help from the government. But I think it's really important to keep in mind, to take a look at where the federal minimum wage is today, where it was in the past. Workers at the federal minimum wage today are making about 30% less than their counterparts a generation ago, despite the fact that they're older, they have more education, higher skills. So they're starting, even if folks are starting out in the labor market, even if this is their first job, even if they are low skilled, they're starting out from a position that is much farther away from the middle class than their predecessors in the previous generation. And that's going to hamstring them for the rest of their lives, the rest of their careers, the rest of their time in the labor market.
Let's talk about what happens if we commit to a living wage, let's say as a cultural move. Do Americans have to commit to paying a little bit more across the board if we all want to commit to the idea of a living wage that raises all of us up?
So very good question, Todd. And I think the key here is a little bit. In fact, what we're seeing is that, yes, there is a little bit passed on to the consumers, but the consumers don't seem to be reducing the amount that they buy. And so the benefits actually go to those low-wage workers. And again, we know that those low-wage workers spend quite a bit of money themselves.
And if prices are low at Target, maybe another dollar an hour or something at a place, not singling you out, Target, but a place like Target, might mean that more people spend at Target, right?
That's exactly right.
Now, we've been getting a lot of response from a sector of the workforce that has a particular interest in the living wage, people with disabilities. We've been hearing from them on their phones. We've been hearing from them as we've been prepping this show. William, you're in Florida. You've been listening to our reporters and our experts. Tell me about your experience in the workforce, your wages, and what it takes for you to get by.
Well, I make $16 an hour. My wife is disabled. My biggest concern is if they go up on minimum wage, my company is not going to give me enough raise to offset the difference. So if y'all go from $8 an hour to $14 an hour minimum wage, well, I just lost $6 an hour buying power, and I might get a raise for another dollar an hour. So you have put me in a situation, my wife and I, into a lower income bracket. Hmm.
William, thanks for joining us. David, it's an important point. Now, William makes $16 an hour. He's worried that if a wage mandate boosts that mandate too high, that he's not going to lose his job, but he's just not going to get the raises that he needs to keep he and his wife healthy and making it.
Well, first of all, I think as Dr. Kugler was saying, we know that the price response from a minimum wage increase tends to be very small. So in other words, even though William may have to pay a little more for the things he goes out and buys, it's not going to be that much. But secondly,
he's also worried about his employer saying, well, I've got to meet this mandate for all the other people. So, William, I can't give you that raise to 19. It can only be $17.50.
I mean, it is true that if an employer has to pay their lowest paid workers a little bit more, they may defer some of the increases higher up the wage ladder. But, you know, again, we have to try and think about what folks at the absolute bottom are making, and are they able to afford their needs? The other point I thought he was making was that, you know, his wife relies on some federal assistance programs, and he's concerned that if his income goes up, that he's going to lose some of those benefits as a result of the higher pay he's getting. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the vast majority of those programs are not one, they don't reduce your benefits one-to-one. So in other words, for every additional dollar in income you receive, you're not going to lose a dollar in benefits. So on net, he should be better off.
We got this call from Keith in Fort Myers, Florida, who left a message sharing his experience with us.
Hi, my name is Keith. I'm from Fort Myers, Florida. I happen to be a disabled veteran and a old registered nurse, EMT, paramedic, firefighter even. Living on Social Security disability makes things very tight. I've had to resort to visiting food pantries as much as possible, but even that can be sometimes difficult with my health conditions and trying to get up and going. I had to resort to asking the minister of our church a couple times for funds as well. And it's a shame that we've got to live this way.
One question I have for our experts is the question why. It's kind of a simple question, and we can forget to ask it. It seems like with something so big as what people make across America, all the different states, Arkansas versus Ohio, it can just seem like general inertia of the economy that leads to so many millions of Americans not being able to make what it takes. But these are policy decisions. These are the results of decisions of lawmakers, people we elect, people we empower to make decisions about the economy. Help me understand a little bit, Professor, if you can, about how we got here and what the decisions were that led to so many millions of Americans not making a living wage. I mean, the money has gone somewhere.
So I think the key to understanding why we have this inertia in the policy arena is to understand that the people who are being affected by these policies are really the most vulnerable. So there's lack of information and lack of action because they can't afford to even get out there. And to get the support of everybody else, people would need to understand much better what the general benefits to the economy are. And I don't think that's very well understood today.
I just want to add a little historical context here. Throughout the 1970s, Congress raised the federal minimum wage a handful of times, but it was a period of pretty high inflation, so the value kept sort of stayed flat. Throughout the 1980s, we didn't touch the minimum wage at all. So it stayed where it was, and over that time, inflation was just eating away at its value. And the increases that we've made in the federal minimum wage since then in the 1990s and the 2000s have never been large enough to undo that erosion in value that took place throughout the 1980s. So that, I think, is also, you know, important to understand that this is the decision of folks in power to neglect this policy, and in doing so, leave millions of workers today earning less than they would be earning otherwise.
We should stop talking about the federal minimum wage staying stagnant since 1999. It's gone down because what you can buy with that money goes down year after year after year. The purchasing power is worse.
Since 2009, not 1999.
Sorry, 2009
has declined about 17% since 2009.
We got this note from Ellis who says, as a consumer, I don't mind paying a little bit extra on my purchases. I know that if the people working at Target or McDonald's, et cetera, are being fairly compensated for their time, that it's worth my money. And we got this from Blue Appalachia. Why can't the CEOs and the people at the top take a pay cut in order to pay for people to make a living wage? Now, that gets to the big national debate about income inequality. Maybe there's not going to be a direct flow from the CEOs on down, but please tell me how overall income inequality and wage disparity in this country is connected to the problem, Professor.
So that's a very good point. In fact, we know that when you pay the minimum wage, not only minimum wage workers benefit, but also people above the minimum wage. There is what is known as a spillover effect. So this increase in the minimum wage also raises the wages for those above the minimum wage and close to the minimum wage. There is a generalized improvement for everybody down in the lower end of the distribution that would lead to compression and less inequality. And that's exactly what we've seen from evidence in the past from increases in the minimum wage.
Sasha, I want to get your final thoughts because I live in the District of Columbia too, and it's a place where a lot of high-paid people are moving in, and you're reporting on the people who are just trying to get by.
Who are just trying to get by, and I would be remiss if I did not mention that Washington, D.C. officials are hoping to entice other local businesses to pay their employees fair wages, and they're also trying to reward businesses for doing so. So they're implementing the living wage certification program that's going to happen sometime this year. Not sure when. Talks are still happening as to what exactly it'll look like. And so it'll be something, whether it's a sign hanging in your store that says we're a living wage business or employees walk around with T-shirts.
Let them advertise
something to entice others to do the same and for shoppers to want to reward you for doing
so
what you're supposed to be doing.
Those of us with wallets can take action with our dollars
exactly
in the local community.
Vote with your wallet.
WAMU's race and identity reporter, Sasha Natasha Ann Simons. Great reporting. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. Adriana Kluger is a professor of economics and foreign policy at Georgetown University, former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor in the Obama administration, 2011 to 2013. Thank you so much for your expertise, Professor. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Todd.
David Cooper is senior economic analysis at the Economic Policy Institute, EPI. We heard your numbers thrown around here during the conversation. David, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
This program was produced by Morgan Givens and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A. We'll be right back.